The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Austin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Legal Matters. For the next half hour, we'll explore topics to help you assert and maintain your legal rights to obtain equal access and full participation in our community and to achieve your goals of independent living. In today's episode, we are honored to have as our guest Judge Lucy Inman, Judge of the North Carolina Court of Appeals. Judge Inman, welcome to Legal Matters, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so very much for inviting me to join you today, Joe. I'm thrilled to be with you and your listeners.
Well, thanks so much. This is a great honor, and you can give us a wonderful civics lesson here about the North Carolina judiciary. But first of all, Judge Inman, introduce yourself to our listeners with a little biographical information. You've got a stellar resume, and don't be too modest now.
Okay, well, thank you. And first of all, Joe, for you and anybody who I should see outside of court, please call me Lucy when we are not in court. I love my job as a judge. We have that formality in court. But outside of court, I'm Lucy. I grew up in Raleigh. My father was a newspaper reporter. My mother was a writer, and I was educated in the public schools from first grade all through law school. Went to Sanderson High School in Raleigh, and from there went to NC State University, where I graduated with a Bachelor's of Arts degree in English. And despite State being known for nuclear physicists and other super brainy scientists, they also have a great English department and a creative writing department. From there, I went to work as a newspaper reporter for a few years. And it was as a newspaper reporter that I had my first experience in court. I covered, before I covered the courts, I covered the crimes and emergencies beat and would meet all sorts of people, usually on the worst days of their lives. But I really, really enjoyed seeing the strength in people on the worst days of their lives. And then when I went over to cover courts, it was much like covering crimes and emergencies, except that the dust has settled and people were dressed up and they were in court. And instead of asking who, what, where did these things happen, it was more, why did these things happen and what are the consequences of these things happening? And it was just a great experience for a newspaper reporter, really for any young person. It's like having a front row to humanity every day. And eventually I could assess that very few people who came to court were happy to be there. They may have been a victim of a crime. They may have been charged with a crime or have a family member charged with a crime. They might have a dispute that they could not resolve any other way than going to court. They might have been summoned to come to jury duty, which would mean missing their work or their duties at home and getting compensated very little by the state for being there. But they all wanted the same thing I noticed from the judge, to be treated with respect. And the judge sat in the middle of the courtroom, and the judge's job was to listen to everybody. And that's how people knew they were being treated with respect. I decided from that experience that I was no longer satisfied writing about what happened in the courtroom. I really wanted to participate in that system. So I went to law school in Chapel Hill. And while I was in law school at Chapel Hill, I got to work in the summers for some of my hero lawyers that I had met when I was covering courts in Raleigh. And then my first job out of law school, I clerked for Chief Justice Jim Exum of the North Carolina Supreme Court, and that was just a fantastic opportunity for me, it was a great bridge from school to practice. I then fell in love with a newspaper reporter named Billy Warden. And although I was certain I was going to practice law in North Carolina for the rest of my career, I knew it was true love when I agreed to follow him to Los Angeles and take another state bar. He went to graduate school there, and I practiced there for 8 years. It was super exciting, different kinds of cases than I had here. And then when we had a two-year-old and a second child on the way, I had to persuade my husband, by then a television producer, to move back to North Carolina, where all our family are. And we've been back for 21 years, and I'm so glad to be back in North Carolina. I practiced when we came back for 10 years and then became a Superior Court judge and held court all over the state, including in Johnson County. And really loved that. And then in 2014, I was elected to the North Carolina Court of Appeals, where I'm serving now. Well, I could be long-winded, so that was more of a resume than you
know. That was great, Lucy. That was great. And let me just, to our dear listeners, let me tell you that Lucy was way too modest. She graduated from NC State with summa cum laude honors, and while she was at UNC Law School, she was the articles editor of the Law Review, and that's not checking footnotes. That is dealing with law professors who submit articles, and I'm sure they give you a hard time when you try to edit them, but nobody had better credentials for editing than Lucy. And the Chief Justice that Lucy clerked for, Justice Exum, was the Chief Justice during a period of time when the court really opened up North Carolina jurisprudence and expanded rights and remedies in a historic kind of way. And so when you came back to North Carolina to the private practice of law, Lucy, you spoke about the humanity, and you went to work for one of the most humane plaintiff's lawyers that I've ever known, Liz Cunaholm. Tell us a little bit about your experience in private practice when you came back to North Carolina.
Well, when I came back to North Carolina, I was at that point, I want to say, 7 months pregnant, and Liz Cunaholm had worked in a firm in Raleigh with Wade Smith's law firm when I was in law school, and so I had worked with her some there. And I had been in Los Angeles practicing commercial litigation, a lot of First Amendment work, and a lot of disputes, sometimes with individuals, but often just big companies. Liz Cunningham's practice, that Wade Smith called the Mission Church, was dedicated to representing people who really had no other voice. These were people who had lost a loved one or had a loved one with catastrophic and permanent injuries, from anything from a car accident to a preventable medical mishap, and also represented victims of sexual abuse. These were often people, if they had medical expenses for the rest of their lives, it wasn't a choice for them to bring a lawsuit. They had to if they were going to possibly take care of themselves. And the victims of sexual abuse, we counseled as many people as we represented in court. And by that I mean there are a lot of abuse situations that happen that are very, very difficult to prove in court. It could be a swearing contest between the alleged abuser and the victim. And I learned in that work that people who have other people who already are dealing with challenges in life, whether they are have a mental disability, a physical disability, whether they have or kids with no parents at home. Those are the people who sexual predators seek out, and it makes it difficult for those victims to obtain recovery. It makes them difficult to be witnesses in court. I loved the work, and I could not have done it without Liz really making that possible. She did, because I was 8 months pregnant by the time, I guess I started when I was 7 months pregnant and 8 months when I was full time with her. She also represented a lot of families whose children had had permanent injuries in the course of birth, and she excused me from doing work on any birth injury cases until my second child was born, which I was grateful for. But it was hard work, and she's one of the most personally generous people I've ever worked with. Our clients, unlike my clients in Los Angeles, were not business executives or movie stars. They were regular folks who were dealing with a situation that was life-changing.
Well, you know, you and Liz made a powerful team, but as the great philosopher George Benson says, everything must change. And so Liz ultimately retired, and I believe that Governor Perdue appointed you to the Superior Court bench. Have I got that much history correct?
That is absolutely correct. Governor Perdue appointed me to a Superior Court seat in 2010, and I am forever grateful to her for that. The difference between working as a lawyer and working as a judge, at least the kind of practice I was in, we didn't have a high volume practice. We our cases took a lot of time for each individual. And by working as a judge, I was really able to touch many more lives and also be able to listen to both sides. Liz was is a great champion for the underdog, and I loved working as a champion for the underdog. But I don't know how many years you've been in practice, Joe. It's a tough career. When my older child was not quite four, he was in my office drawing pictures, and he drew a picture of a creature that had spikes on every surface of its body. And I said, "Will, what is that creature?" And he said with a deep voice, "It's a litigator. It's a trial attorney." So going to become a judge was a great opportunity, and for my personality, it was also very fitting to dial down the volume a little bit and really have the job of being careful and honest and fair, and not having the job that a trial lawyer has, as you know, which is to move mountains for people who really need you to.
And you were a Superior Court judge, and of course, our listeners will need a little bit of a civics lesson. Our trial division is made up of the District Court and the Superior Court, where Lucy was a judge, and then we have two divisions of the Appellate Court, the Court of Appeals. And so, at some point, decided to run for the Court of Appeals successfully. Tell us about that thought process.
Sure, I will. And in the Superior Court, I think your listeners may, if someone gets a traffic ticket, or if they're getting divorced, or if they're having a dispute about custody of children, that's in District Court. And then in the Superior Court, where I was, would be major felony crimes and civil disputes that don't have to do with the family, any kind of matters, and also constitutional challenges. If for any of your listeners old enough to remember Perry Mason, that's Superior Court. I'm sure there's many other courtroom dramas. They're, most people's idea of a courtroom is like Superior Court, where there are jurors. And I loved doing that work. I probably would have kept on doing it, but the legislature changed the seat that I was in. The legislature passed a bill, and that seat became a different kind of seat. It was subject to approval in the legislature and nomination of another governor. And I learned that a court of appeals judge was retiring, and I decided that I would run for election to the court of appeals. I love writing. I've always loved writing. And at the court of appeals, I'm able to spend more time on cases. And in the courtroom, like a regular trial judge, you show people that you're listening by engaging with them and you know, responding to people's needs. At the appellate courts, we don't have witnesses. We don't have juries. This is where someone is disappointed and disagrees with the outcome of their trial below. They appeal to the Court of Appeals. And we just hear arguments from lawyers, and then we write opinions. And the way that the appellate court shows the lawyers and the parties and the public that they are listening is to write a careful opinion. It's always been my view that anything that's a public record should be written so that most members of the public can understand it. I love crafting, writing about these cases in a way that you don't need to have a law degree to understand. And that's what I'm able to do at the Court of Appeals. I also never, as a lawyer, represented parents in custody disputes or in divorce proceedings. But we review those cases. There are other judges at the Court of Appeals who have that background. And you know this, Joe. You know, the most important talent you can bring as a lawyer is not a boatload of knowledge you already have, but the ability to learn. And we learn every day at the Court of Appeals.
And you touched on something there about your affinity for writing, and certainly you were a reporter for a newspaper, and do you bring those skills to bear in your attempts to fulfill that philosophy of making the opinions intelligible?
I do. What I try to do is at the beginning of an opinion, there are different, there's no right answer. There's no required way to do it. But what I like to do at the beginning of every legal opinion is say, this case is about whatever. And then say, this is the dispute. And then say, this is how we've resolved it. So that if you do not or have no interest in whatever the dispute is about, or that area of law, you don't have to read past the first paragraph. You just don't have to read past the first paragraph. And I like being able to save people time in that way. Just Chief Justice Exum told me when I clerked for him that the legislature in our state holds the purse. The governor holds, the executive branch holds the sword and the power to do things. The courts really get their power only from the confidence of the people. And you're not going to get the confidence of the people if they cannot understand why you did what you did. If people don't have confidence in the courts, our democracy is in big, big trouble. So the writing needs to be not merely entertaining, but understandable. My, you know, the highest compliment anybody ever paid me, I guess it was when I was a trial judge. I had a trial, and there was a plaintiff who was a man who'd been injured by biting into a snack cake that he bought at a convenience store and broke his tooth, and he sued and sought recovery for many, many medical problems, and he wasn't successful. During the trial, he seemed to me to be not in a good mood, and he lost the trial. A few weeks later, I was amazed to get a letter from him thanking me for making sure he had a fair trial.
Wow.
And if somebody who loses a case feels like it was handled fairly, that's my goal.
Well, I only appeared before you when you were on the Superior Court bench one time. And, I will say, I can give direct testimony that was exactly how my clients felt, and we ended up working things out with the other side. But we had very beneficial discussions with you in chambers, and that helped us clear things up. Anything else that about your judicial philosophy that you want to share with us? And also, I know that your the current term of office is running out pretty soon. What's on the horizon for you? So that's several questions in one there, but I give you the floor.
Well, thank you so much. Well, I guess the only other thing I'd say about my judicial philosophy is, again, words really, really matter. The words in our federal constitution, the words in our state constitution, the words in the statutes. And Chief Justice Exum taught me that it's really important that judges follow the law, even when following the law might lead to an outcome that we personally wish was not the case. If you'd like to make the outcome the way you want it to be, you could go serve in the legislature. But if you're a judge, you really have to follow the rule of law. And the reason that's so important is for the consistency. Everybody needs to be treated equally, and the way we do that is to apply the rules the same to every person. We also have to be aware of our changing society and be courageous enough to acknowledge when there are inequities, when there is unfairness. In 1954, the United States Supreme Court issued its decision in Brown versus Board of Education and held for the first time that racial segregation of the schools, public schools, was unconstitutional. That was a landmark decision. It was not a popular decision. It was not a popular decision in North Carolina, and I think we've come a long ways from then. More recently, and the thing that I really love about serving on the North Carolina Court of Appeals, and I will say next year I have to choose between running for reelection or running for what I anticipate will be an open seat on the Supreme Court, and I plan to run for the open seat if that happens. And the reason that I want to serve on the Supreme Court is it has greater latitude than the Court of Appeals. The court that I serve on, the Court of Appeals, is always bound by precedent from other decisions from the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. And I'll give you an example of an inspiring decision that our Supreme Court just issued. North Carolina's Constitution, unlike the federal Constitution, provides a right for a sound basic education for every person. Some of your listeners may have heard of a case called Leandro, which was decided 20 years ago and held that if you're in the poorest county in North Carolina, you still have a right to a sound basic education. And the legislature needs to provide funding so that you can get the same education as somebody who lives in a rich county. There was a case that was recently decided by our Supreme Court called Deminsky versus Board of Education. And that case involved some children who were harassed almost daily by other students in their classroom. A woman brought the lawsuit after she had transferred her three children to another school. And the reason she transferred them was that students, boys in the girls' class, were making sexual remarks to her, were assaulting her, and making it impossible for her to, you know, get through the school day. And at the Court of Appeals, where I sit, we heard the case first. And there had been a previous decision by the Court of Appeals which said that to fall within this constitutional right to a sound basic education, you have to be presenting something about actual education, like what's the textbook? What's the textbook that's available to you? What teachers are available to you? And in an earlier case, a teacher had had a sexual relationship with a student, and the Court of Appeals said that doesn't count. That doesn't violate the constitutional right to education. And so when this new case came along, the Court of Appeals again decided, well, we're bound by that earlier decision, and we're going to have to say, no, you don't have a constitutional claim based on sexual harassment by other students in the classroom. The North Carolina Supreme Court, which is not bound by the precedent of previous decisions of the Court of Appeals, reversed and said, yes, you have stated a constitutional claim. If your child is going to school and getting harassed every day, and you're telling the teacher and you're telling the principal, and they're not doing anything about it, your child's right to a sound basic education has been violated, and you can get relief for that. That is part of the North Carolina Constitution that makes our state special, and there are other areas of our state constitution like that that differ from the federal constitution. You can't get this relief in the federal courts. You've got to get this relief in North Carolina, and the North Carolina Supreme Court has the last word on these rights.
Well, on that happy note, we've run out of time, Lucy. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Legal Matters and learned many things about the North Carolina judiciary from Judge Lucy Inman. I'm Joe Austin for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Legal Matters is available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.